When you make it as a Bitcoiner, you deserve it because you took the risk that most other people don't take because they're too afraid. They like living in the safety bubble right here. This is their whole life inside this circle. I wanted to bust out that bubble and see what else is out there. How can I make the bubble any bigger? That's what my mind frame is. And if I fail, okay, so what? I learned something, I'll go back to my old job and continue on ticking, but at least I tried. Went online and found out that there is no museum for Bitcoin. I'm like, hey, why don't I be the first one?
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 860053, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is the Coin Dad. He's the creator of the Bitcoin Mining Museum. We get into his fascinating history and how the museum got started. Walk through the history of Bitcoin mining, talk about mining centralization risks, small town America mining Bitcoin at home, and a whole lot more about mining Bitcoin and some other stuff. This was a really interesting conversation. I think you're going to learn a lot you didn't know before about the history of Bitcoin mining. I know I did. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast, wherever you're listening or watching. And do me a favor and check out my sponsor, Bitbox, in the show notes, or go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source, Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. You can also grab links to protect yourself from SIM swap attacks while getting 5G service by using Afani or Cloaked Wireless. I'm a one-man show, so when you use my partner links, it genuinely helps me keep this show running, and I really appreciate it. If you'd rather watch this show than listen, head to the show notes for links to watch on YouTube, Rumble, and on Noster via Highlighter. But if you're like me and you prefer to just listen to your podcasts, I highly recommend you check out Fountain.fm. Not only can you send Bitcoin to your favorite podcasters to give value for value, but you can earn Bitcoin just for listening to this fucking podcast. Finally, if you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media, through the website bitcoinpodcast.net, or shoot me an email. It's hello@bitcoinpodcast.net. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with the Coin Dad. Man, welcome. Good to see you. Been not too long. We saw each other in Nashville. It was a good time.
Yeah, it was. Just a couple months ago. Time flies, though. It does feel like it was just like 2 weeks ago.
It's, yeah, I don't know. Time moves strange. You know, I got the young kid now, our son.
Congratulations on that, by the way. I think Apollo is the name, right?
You got it. Yeah. And it's wild because, like, time already, you know, the older you get, the more you notice time speeding up because it's your relative sense of time, right? You know, a year for you when you're, well, you know, when you're 1 year old, that's your whole life. But a year for you when you're 20, that's only 120, you know, and so on and so forth. But it's like something about now having a kid, it's like time is just really, really flying by in a good way too, though. It's like, cause I'm seeing the milestones that he's hitting and it's like, man, just it's cool to see. Changes your time preference too.
It does. That's for sure. Because your priorities change and you have a whole new purpose on life now as a father that somebody's depending on you. So you're investing more of your 24-hour day into him versus, you know, scrolling up and down on your cell phone and all that stuff like a lot of other people do that don't have kids. Time flies when you're dealing with children.
Amen. Yeah, it feels very good though. It's like your time has more purpose to it. And even like the time you're not spending with your kid is like, well, this is time that I'm building something for my kid. Like, you know, it's not just, you know, me and my lovely wife anymore. It's like, okay, someone's going to be here after we're gone and I want to do what I can to build for them, you know, long after I'm dead, but hope to be able to, you know, leave something there behind. And you know, thank God for Bitcoin in that sense.
Give them a better life, but yeah, Don't make it too easy on them because they still have to learn their own way, become their own man. And that process is like that. I don't believe, like, for example, with me, with my paperwork. Like if I was to die tomorrow, my paperwork is set up in such a way that my son does not get everything that I worked for, because I don't believe in free handouts, even for my own children. I got two boys. They're grown now in their 20s. But like he would have to show that he's got his bachelor's degree and like prove to the lawyer that he's not some gang member, or he's not locked up in jail somewhere. Like there's certain criteria that I set up in writing that you have to meet before you get anything from me, even after I'm gone.
I think that's actually a kind of a smart way to do it, because it's like if they are building, like it's, first of all, it's good that you've got the planning in place already, because I'm sure you're going to be here for a long time still, a good long time. You know, shit happens. And a lot of people don't think about this stuff until it's really too late. But I think that's a nice way to do it, is to have some contingencies in there. Because I mean, I know some kids, like some kids I went to college with come to mind, that like, I mean, nicest parents you can imagine, spent time with their parents and everything, you know, just very, very successful and everything. And the kids, nice as can be, but like zero work ethic whatsoever, because they never had to work for anything. But I mean, I know other kids that came from plenty of money and work their asses off and take nothing for granted, and they're better for it. And not that their, you know, parents aren't there if they need them, but they want to make it on their own. I think that's what it is. It's like you want to instill in your kids that grit, that desire to hustle, to make it on your own. And yeah, if you've got something to fall back on, sure, that's a privilege. That's very nice. But you want to be able to do it of your, you know, on your own right. I think that's the key. I mean, easier said than done, I'm sure. I'm only less than a year in, so I'm not an expert on this by any means yet, but figuring it out as I go.
It is a very important year. This year and next year is very important, because at that age or that phase in life, even though they physically can't do much except lay there, their brain is a sponge. And everything you say, everything you do, everything you act around them, they will duplicate that in a few years from now. So they're already learning now. Like, I actually remember the very first time that my son was only, I think he was only 10 months old. And I had my dad gave me a hand-down car at the time, and I just got married, and I put him in the baby seat in the back because we were getting ready to go somewhere, and I put the baby seat, the belt over him in the car seat, and as I'm putting it over, he literally punched, like hit my hand and said, "No, like I don't want that over me." Like he got a little aggressive at 10 months. Like he didn't say no, but his actions, you know?
Yeah.
And as soon as he did that, I spun him around and popped him in the diaper. Not hard, but enough where he wanted to cry, but didn't cry. Nothing came out of him. He's just like, he didn't know what to do, because that's his first experience from his dad of disciplining him and putting him in line. And never have I had an issue. As soon as I put that over his head after that, he just sat there and said, "No problem."
Yeah, you know? All right. Happy to be along for the ride.
It was a tiny, even though it was only 10 months old, and I'm not an abusive dad by no means. There's a difference between beating up a child and disciplining a child because you love him. You know, that was my tough love moment for my son, but it worked. I haven't had, growing up, I didn't have much issue with him. He's been a good kid. But it's, you have to start early, because if you wait until you're 3 years old, 4 years old, it's almost too late by then.
You see some kids, you know, like you're out and about and you see some kids, like I saw a kid the other day, I was at Home Depot and some kid was literally, he must have been maybe three or four. I saw him just smack his mom in the face. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, and just was, you know, was not like in a tantrum of some sort. But he wasn't like crying his head off. He was just, I don't know what his problem was. But then his mom was like trying to speak to him very reasonably and just like hauled off and smacked her. And it's like, man, it's going to keep getting worse there before it gets better.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, again, I don't know what I'm doing.
You want to intervene, but you really can't because that's not your child. But
Let me go get some charcoal and whatever else I came for, and I'll see you later. Yeah. But yeah, what I do love about it, like I thought I had an idea of what a low time preference meant before having a kid. And then, sure, you know, you like, first time I encountered that term was reading a Saifedean's book, you know, Bitcoin Standard. And that was such like kind of a light bulb moment of like, oh, wow, this really makes sense. And yeah, this is something to strive for. And you can think these things kind of theoretically and like, yeah, I want to, you know, push out my time horizon and everything. But then you have a kid and you're like, wow, now I get it, because I care about the time that will, you know, that will be happening long after I'm gone. And I feel like it's, you can't have that true switch. Like I describe it like having a kid, at least so far for me, is like somebody flipped a light switch on and then they ripped that socket out of the wall and you can't turn that off anymore. You're in it now and you are changed and for the better, but there's no going back. And hopefully, I think for most people, it's a very positive change. I don't, you know, not everybody maybe feels that way, but I sure do. I'm sure you do. It's a perspective shift.
Well, I'm raised old school. I'm not an American. I'm an immigrant. And when I'm from Germany, I was born and raised there, but my parents are both Romanian. So I speak German and Romanian fluently. As fluently as possible, anyway. It's been a while. But I remember that my grandmother from Romania, named Bobby, she was the most wholesome woman I've ever met in my life. Like, she was born with no teeth and died with no teeth, born with no money and died with no money. And she just had a smile the entire 99 years in between. Like, she was the last person to eat at the dinner table. She was the first person to serve everybody else. And it's a huge learning moment from her. But I remember when my parents both had to work because we moved to the U.S., it was tough. So she was the one that was like my babysitter, and I didn't really speak that good Romanian, so I kind of learned it from her because she kind of partially raised me while my parents were working. But I remember the word vaguța, which this is a little skinny stick from a tree that's stayed on top of the refrigerator. And if I got out of line, I got that little skinny twig, that branch, whooped right across my butt or my back or wherever, my arms. And at one point, I remember eating dinner, and I cannot stand Brussels sprouts. To me, they stink, and I don't like them. And she made me eat them, and I didn't want to eat them. So every time she turned around in the kitchen, I stuck them in my pocket, like in my pants under the table. And then she turned around, and she caught me putting some in there. And then she came with this vaguța, and then the vaguța broke because I got older, so I was able to handle it. And then she was like, okay, I got something for you since you're breaking my vaguța now. She put rice, uncooked rice, on the tile in the kitchen and made me knee on it. And I was like 9 or 10 years old. But today, that would probably be considered some sort of torture for a child, you know? But looking back at it today, it's like I thank her for it. Like, she kept me in line through moments when my parents weren't around. It's almost like a village raising the child, which doesn't happen anymore nowadays. Everything is just running free all over the place. Everybody wants to do what they want to do. You know, parents give their kids a tablet, and as long as they're scrolling up and down on their whatever is on there in the back seat of the car, then the parents can continue on with their own life and do what they need to do. It's frustrating to see.
Yeah, well, and meanwhile, the parents continuing on with their own life usually means scrolling on their own tablets the same time. You know, it's so funny, just the community aspect of family, because I think that's something that it's really sad that a lot of that has been lost, I think, in modern America. I think you still see it a lot internationally. You know, you travel and you see that more. And I think it's such an important thing, like for children, no matter what age they are, to be spending time with the older members of their family or the other younger members of their family, cousins, aunts, uncles, but grandparents especially, because that's that intergenerational bond, I think, is so important. And we've gotten to this weird point in America where it's like, even though everyone can, you know, not everyone, even though a lot of people can work remotely now, you still and have the capability to basically live anywhere they choose, which is what a privilege that is. But you still don't see people living, oftentimes not even within a day's drive of their family. You know, like you can't, you know, you can't even hop in. You gotta jump in a flight, whatever. And I think that's so sad. I think that that's something that we need to get back to. Like, I've got my parents here right now, hanging out with my son, and they love it so much, and it's so great for him too. And it's sad that we have lost a lot of that in America. I think there's a movement. I mean, at least from what I see with a lot of Bitcoiners, which is who I spend at least the most time with online and a growing amount of time with in person, there's a change, I think, coming, a positive change. But we got away from that a little bit. And I think that's like, I mean, shame on us, because that's something that I think that's what builds a strong family. It's not just, yeah, it's the mom and the dad and the kids, but it's the grandparents, it's the aunts and uncles, it's all of that. That's your first layer of community. And I think it's so important.
I'm all for decentralized money with Bitcoin, but I'm not for decentralized family. You have to stick together, especially through moments like when we had COVID and all that stuff. You know, that's all you basically had was family. And some of them weren't able to see each other because of the rules and regulations at that time. But that's something, my parents are getting older now. They're retired. Matter of fact, they're coming up here in a couple of weeks and spending a few weeks with us. Because of the blessings of Bitcoin, I was able to buy a large chunk of land and build our retirement home here. So my wife and I have been blessed from that. But my parents still live in the city, and they're kind of stuck there. They're grandfathered in with property taxes, so they're paying a good rate. They're on their fixed income. Took me a while for me to orange pill them and get some of that retirement money over into Bitcoin to help them, which I'm glad they did, because they got in at roughly 20 grand, so they're already up with their retirement. But being on a fixed income with retired people at that age in this world right now, where everything is moving up around them in price, my dad had to sell his car and downsize the car just so he can get cheaper insurance. I mean, you're kind of nitpicking at that when you get older, if you're still in the fiat world, and it's kind of sad. And some people at that age are still actually going back to part-time jobs now just to make ends meet. But yeah, I'm looking forward to them coming up and spending some time with us. And we all agree that, you know, we need to focus more on Christmases together with family reunions, like my brother and my sister, like everything is all decentralized, and it's very important to have family time.
Amen. I mean, it's the best, right? You know, there's nothing better. And you know, a lot of people, I think nowadays, they talk about not getting along with your family or, you know, having, not being able to stand your family because you differ on some political topic, which I think is just the most ridiculous thing. It's like, you should be, the people you should be most easily able to debate politics with, like really debate with, are your family. Yeah, your family. They're supposed to love you either way. So even if you guys get heated, that's great. You know, hopefully you got some good ideas out there. But like, that shouldn't, you know, be able to break up your family bonds. You know, they should be a little bit stronger than that. I mean, one hopes anyway. I don't know. But well, speaking of family,
with all the narratives being pushed down our throats through every avenue of social media and news and stuff, it's kind of difficult nowadays. Yeah. Really split families and split people and split everything. And it's basically, hey, look over here. This is what we're doing, but we're really doing this over here. We just don't want you to see it. So just keep fighting amongst the family, and they're happy with that.
I mean, if they can get you to fight your family, they can sure as hell get you to fight your neighbor. You know, they're turning the people into enemies that should be your closest, your family, your neighbors, your friends. Those should be the ones that you stick with and try to work with more than, you know, like if you trust your government more than you trust your family, boy, there's something wrong there. That's something really wrong.
Spend more time every day with people that love you back.
Amen to that. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, because I like to start these things off just with a general question. And, you know, you and I got to talking about this a bit in Nashville and, you know, a few other times before as well. But just, you've got quite an interesting story for how you got here today. So I'd like to just start us off with, who are you and how did you get here today to be doing what you're doing, to have a wall of miners behind you right now? Pretty cool backdrop for those that are just listening and not watching. It's a nice sight to see. And I think it's just a small fraction.
It is. Well, this is actually extra stuff. This is not the media. Okay. So this is actually just my stay in the office, like backup, I guess, for certain miners. But yeah, my name's Tobias Barbier, and they call me the coin dad in the Bitcoin world. I've been around since early 2017. I don't even know where you want me to start from. What, age 2, age 10, when I came to the U.S.?
Hey,
I've learned a lot of stuff in my life. Let me put it that way.
Whatever feels right.
Well, like I said, I guess I'll start from where I said earlier, where I'm an immigrant. I came from Germany. I was still young, around 10. My grandparents moved here first, and my dad followed suit. So my mom and dad got settled here. Started in I think my dad was making $5 or $6 an hour with his first job taking care of us back in the late 80s. It got to the point where I finished my green card paperwork under my dad, but then I turned 18 myself, and then I was left on my own to have to deal with getting my citizenship. So I was trying to figure out how to get that pretty quickly, and then I found that there's a path through citizenship by joining the U.S. Army, as long as you serve 3 years active duty. So I signed up for the military, and through that, I ended up learning a career in logistics. I sped through the process of getting my citizenship, became a U.S. citizen, and in that process, I had to learn English from scratch. I didn't know any English when I moved here. I had to learn about the history of America. I went through standing in line, I remember, for hours at a time just to get to the front to go and fill out paperwork to turn into them and pay, I think at one point, $2,000 I had to pay. And it took, you know, a few years for things to come back and finalize. So technically, for what's going on today with our border, it's like, to me, it's like an extra bothersome, because I went through all the motions to doing everything to become a legit citizen. And then even from there on, I paid my taxes. I served my country. I've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, Dubai, Bahrain, Qatar. And then that was even after the Army. When I got out, I did Department of Defense DOD job, and then I became a state employee in the state of North Carolina after that. So I worked for the government for close to 15 years in and out, different parts of the government. I met my wife in the war zone in Afghanistan. I actually met her online first on a dating website, because I was in a tent in the desert in the war zone, and I was bored at the time. It was at that moment was really nothing going on. So I'm online, like, looking for somebody to talk to and somebody to get to know. And I ran across her profile, and I was intrigued by how she presented herself in her bio. So I sent her a message. And the crazy part is that she was in Miami, 10 minutes away from my parents, where they live. I'm in the war zone in Afghanistan. And my message comes through at the very exact moment where she's on her profile in the app, in the website, getting ready to delete everything because she was only being hit up by older men and she didn't like it. So she was like, her finger is on the way to the button to click delete on her profile as my message popped up. And she's like, who the heck is this guy? So she, instead of closing everything and hitting that button, which is just 1 second away, she opens up my message and sees me and responds to me. And that's how we started our interaction when we first met. So it's like one more second would pass, I wouldn't be married to 12 years now to the awesome wife that I have today. So that's kind of a crazy moment there. But she ended up being ex-military too, staff sergeant in the Army. So I helped her get a job in DOD and come to the war zone with us and work in Afghanistan. And from the 120 bases that they had in the Middle East at the time, they actually assigned her to my base. So what are the odds of that?
Wow.
One out of 120. And you end up working on the same base as me. So I'm in the logistics warehouse on one side of the airfield. And then on the other side is her. She was doing IT because she has a master's and bachelor's in IT. And she was working over there. And then in 2012, we got bombed with mortar rounds right between me and her. So I'm in a bunker, she's in the bunker, and we're like texting each other on the little Afghan Nokia phones. You know, those diddly-doo, 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 those. And then I'm like, are you alive? You know, I'm like, I hope she's okay. And then same thing, she messaged me. And from there, things got more serious. Jeez, one memory after another is just popping up. So after like 4 months on that base with her, we decided to go home for Thanksgiving. And we left a week early to give us time to make it home and adjust and all that. So we flew on a Chinook helicopter from our base to Kandahar. In Kandahar, we tried to get on a flight that got canceled. And then they did priority flights for other people ahead of us. So we got bumped back 4 days in a row. So we ended up sleeping on metal benches in the makeshift tent at the airport there. It sucked. Like, we were doing bird baths in the bathroom because we couldn't take a regular shower. So we're just every day wiping armpits and stuff like that with baby wipes and things of that nature. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, the sergeant comes and taps us on the shoulder to wake us up and says, we got an unexpected galaxy, the biggest airplane that the Air Force has. I think the Galaxy C-5. It landed to do an unexpected fueling. So they were like, that's going to Norfolk, Virginia. If y'all want to go to the U.S., you can jump on that one right now. There's plenty of seats. And I'm like, heck yeah, we've been here for 4 days. So we got like 2 days to go to make it home. So we take off, and it goes from Afghanistan around Iran's airspace over Kuwait, Iraq, and then right over ISIS territory in Mosul, Iraq. The pilot gets on the intercom, and with this, I never forget his tone, ladies and gentlemen, we just lost an engine. We're going to do an emergency landing in Cyrillic Air Force Base, Turkey. Please put your seatbelts on. And my wife and I are like, because the plane is almost empty, we're sleeping across four seats, like just spread out. And we looked at each other like, did he really just say that we lost an engine? But he said it like it's his fifth time. You know what I mean? So we're on our way home, and here we are doing an emergency landing now in Turkey. We land, and then they put us in the Turkey Army barracks there, and they swapped out the engine overnight and put us back on the same plane the next day.
Wow.
And then from there, we fly to go to Norfolk to continue our trip. But then we get to Rota, Spain, right when you get to the Atlantic Ocean, the beginning of it in Spain. And then he gets back on the intercom and says, yeah, we're too tired to fly over the Atlantic, so we're going to do we're going to land here in Spain and get rest for the night. Basically, we had to find our own way home from Spain. So now we're stuck in the airport in Spain for 11 hours until a charter plane showed up that ended up going to Norfolk, Virginia, to the same airport that we were going to anyway. So we get on that one and we land on Thanksgiving Day. But mind you, we're having to try to get to Miami, not Norfolk, Virginia. So we're in Virginia, and we had our bulletproof vest and our Kevlar and our PPE with us. You have to turn that into an army base to the depot over there before you can leave the army base and go home. So we land, but we landed on an Air Force base. There was no army base around for us to turn the stuff in. So I had to spend, I think at the time in 2012, $110, which was a lot of money in today's money, probably $300-$400. $110 for a taxi to drive us from the Air Force base to an army base in the northern part of Virginia, further north, about an hour and something. Then we get there, and the place is closed because it's Thanksgiving Day. There's parking lot's empty. So we're sitting here with all this gear that we have to turn in. We can't leave until we turn it in, have a receipt. And out of the blue, it's just us and the taxi. And out of the blue, a car rolls up where the sergeant who was in charge of that warehouse for that turn-in process forgot a document on his desk in his office and just so happened to show up at that very moment. And he was like, oh yeah, just throw your stuff in my office. And he gave us a hand receipt with his phone number and stuff. Here, this is good enough for now. I'll send you something later in the mail. So I was like, wow, what are the odds of that? So then we go to the commercial airline, and then I order tickets and fly to Miami, and we land in Fort Lauderdale Airport because we're closer to Fort Lauderdale. And we made it to the dinner table 15 minutes before everybody started eating. So Wow. We plan to leave a week early, so we have time, and we make it 15 minutes before dinner time with me and my wife. After all that, it's
That's a trip. Well, and also, thank you both, you and your wife, for your service, and I mean that sincerely, because I may rag on the U.S. government, but I think it's important to separate the government and the bureaucrats who send men and women off to war with the people who are actually doing the service in war. And so I genuinely appreciate your service.
Thank you for saying that. Like, a lot of the people that I worked with, like, are genuine people. They want to do their job right, and they're there for the right reasons. They got their mind frame in the right place. It's the people above us that made all the stupid decisions. And I'm witness that when I was there, the corruption of money that's being spent in the war zones is ridiculous. I'm talking about, I was in logistics. So I've watched where a unit was told to order 100 tires for a Humvee that needs one tire. And it goes through like the KBR and the Halliburtons and the AECOMs of the world, you know, the contractors that are out there working for the Army. They're the ones that go through this whole order process and bring everything in. So it's like I'm seeing 100 Humvee tires sitting in the yard, and they put one on the Humvee that needed it. It's like, why? Or in Shindan, Afghanistan, this was an Afghan base that I was on for a while, where they trained Afghan pilots to try to build Afghan Air Force for the Afghans. So they were training pilots there. They didn't have a living facility or a training facility for helicopter pilots yet. So our taxpayer money paid for a facility to be built. And I was there when they built it. And I think, I forgot, it was a few million dollars that they spent building it. I think 11 million or something. I don't remember exactly. But believe it or not, they had the opening ceremony with the Afghan generals and all that to break it open, you know, for the transfer from the U.S. military to give to them as a gift. And they rejected it because they didn't like the way it was built. It wasn't suited for their religious purposes and the way that they do things. So they rejected the building that we gave them free with our taxpayer money, and then 1 mile down the street built another one. Jeez. The way that they wanted it. It's just mind-blowing. It's frustrating.
It's insane because, like, just those two examples, like, I'm sure I can't even imagine how many more there are like that of just so
There's
much
a lot.
Waste. So
There's
much
a lot.
Waste. And
I honestly believe that it is my background from physically being over there. I've been to 30 countries to date, and I have seen a lot. And I think that life experience is what helped me to understand Bitcoin faster than some people that have a finance degree, that are in finance, that still can't figure Bitcoin out. Like, I'm trying to call her out, but my ex-wife is one of them. Like, I tried to explain it to her, and she has a master's, a bachelor's degree back in the early days. But when I told her about it, like, it was hard for her to grasp. It took a while. And then I hear stories or see people online through on X that some of these guys that are experts in the finance field that make these stupid comments that make no sense to me because I can see that they can't figure Bitcoin out. But then I have no college degree. I've got my high school degree and my military experience and life experience. I've done some courses in college, but it was just, you know, a couple months here and there and that's it. But other than that, I don't have any master's or bachelor's degrees. Most of my stuff is just life experience and common sense. And I was able to grasp Bitcoin in such a way so early on that when I first figured it out, I understood that I needed to HODL. You know, most people don't even understand that part. They don't. They might learn Bitcoin, and but 2, 3, 4 years down the line, understand what HODL really means. I figured that out, like, I think within the first 4 months that I got into Bitcoin back then. And
well, tell me about that. Yeah, well, no, and it's true that there's a lot of folks, like, just having a degree in finance certainly does not make you, I think in many ways it hurts you for really understanding Bitcoin because you're viewing it through that lens. You know, you're a fish in water, but you don't know what water is. But I'm curious what was your kind of Bitcoin moment where you got it? And then how did that lead into, you know, getting into Bitcoin mining?
So my wife and I, when we first got married, We lived in somebody's garage that was turned into an efficiency. So we literally started from nothing. I actually measure life as at the size of your Christmas tree. Our Christmas tree was 2 feet tall, and we were just in one room where everything was in the same room. And then from there, we went to a duplex, and our tree got to 4 foot tall. And then we got to our starter home, and then we got a 6 foot tree. Now we're in a retirement home, and we just had our first 10 foot tree. So, the moment that we were living there, she couldn't find a job. My job was the type of job that she didn't like, I didn't like, I wasn't happy. We were in the middle of nowhere in San Angelo, Texas. I was driving oil tankers to the oil fields where there's nothing but rattlesnakes out in the middle of nowhere. GPS doesn't work. You literally have a paper in your hand that says, make a right at these three large rocks, go a quarter mile down till you see a 10-foot bush, make a left. That was the directions to get to the oil field to pick the oil up. And it was dangerous as hell. Like, I had this thing that reads the gas in the air. Like, if it goes off, you're supposed to hold your breath and then do this with the finger to see which way the wind's blowing and run the opposite direction. It's just a very dangerous job. But I left from there with my wife to North Carolina. And she found a job. And we got settled in, but I couldn't find a job, and I got frustrated, so I was online searching on ways to make money. Through that process, I was doing things like going to yard sales, and I had a strategy down. Like on Friday, I would look up Saturday morning yard sales, and I would see this one opens up at 6:30, this one opens up 7, this one at 8, this one at 8:30. And I put the addresses line in sequence of the openings, and then have my Google Maps ready to go. And I literally would hit up yard sale after yard sale as they're opening up and catch good sales, take beautiful photos, clean them up, and repost them on eBay and double my money. And then that's how I was helping my wife with the bills around the house at the time. But while I was going through that process, I found the documentary called Banking on Bitcoin with Charlie Schrem. So technically, Charlie Schrem is like the first OG that I heard about. And through this documentary, it sparked my interest to go down the rabbit hole. So as I'm learning and studying after that documentary, in the middle of a conversation with my cousin in Georgia, I'm like, hey, have you ever heard about this Bitcoin? And he's like, yeah, I'm mining Bitcoin. I'm like, what the heck is mining? So that's when he taught me about mining Bitcoin, and he sent me a old D3 in the mail, Dash Miner, that he wasn't using. And he actually just started with S9s at the time and scaled his whole basement with S9s to the point where he was blowing his transformer in the street, and they had to come upgrade his transformer, and they're like, what the heck are you doing? But I pissed my wife off with a loud D3 in the bedroom next door from us. And ended up getting a beer cooler and cutting holes in it, running a flex pipe out the window and trying to bring the decibel noise down. And I got my first payout while I was laying next to her in bed at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And she's like, you know, what kind of chick is texting you? Who's texting you at 2 o'clock in the morning? And I was like, yeah, that's my first payout. I got a ding for my payout, which was dope. And from there on, my passion just grew. And I scaled in my garage, and then I went to a shop and rented the shop out, started my LLC, and then I started doing consulting work, and I started from the bottom where I was selling myself as a service for entry-level technician work. So mining sites in North Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina, even all the way up to upstate New York hired me to help deploy the machines and to clean machines. And I just started basic stuff. And from there, I learned from other people. And then I started to grow. And next thing you know, I'm doing project management work where I collected other people that I know were in the space that are doing technician work. So it's like me and 7-8 other guys that would go to like Core Scientific or the CleanSpark facility in Georgia. And we'd help like Core Scientific deploy 18,000 machines in all four of their sites, South Carolina, Georgia, Kentucky, North Carolina. So I got to see a lot of stuff, learn a lot of stuff. Through that process, my shop in North Carolina started to, from all the refurbishment work I did, I started to see different model miners on my shelf. And, you know, I'm just sitting there and And I'm like, oh, that's cool. So I cleaned them up, lined them all up in chronological order. And then I started studying online. And I'm like, oh, there's another one I don't have on eBay. Bought it, you know, $50 here, $100 there. Started getting to the point where I got 10, 20, 30 machines in my shop. Then I looked up Museum for Bitcoin. And it's nothing. There's nothing out there. So that's how I found a niche in the market. I basically, leaving my government job, by the way, was tough. And putting in my resignation to throw a pension out the window. My family told me I was nuts. My friends told me I was nuts. You know, I took this risk. And to me, this is also where I believe that when you make it as a Bitcoiner, you deserve it because you took the risk that most other people don't take because they're too afraid. They like living in the safety bubble right here. This is their whole life inside this circle. I wanted to bust out that bubble and see what else is out there. How can I make the bubble any bigger? That's what my mind frame is. And if I fail, okay, so what? I learned something. I'll go back to my old job and continue on ticking, but at least I tried. Well, sorry to jumping off topic here,
No, I
but
love it. Amen.
so I went online and found out that there is no museum for Bitcoin. And I'm like, hey, why don't I be the first one? So essentially, I created my own job. Like, how awesome is that in itself? Like, nobody in the whole world can claim that they're doing what I do. And right now, just for me sitting here in front of you in this podcast, I'm surrounded by the backbone of Bitcoin. And it's these machines behind me that created my job, that created your job, that created what Michael Saylor's doing, that created what the Bitcoin conference is doing, David Bailey, everybody. Name it in the space that's all attached to these machines behind me. If it's not for them, nobody else would be here with a job. So from there on, I started to build the whole museum idea. And then I contacted Michael from the Mining Disrupt Conference in Miami, and I showed him photos of what I'm building. And I would like to show it to the community. And he gave me my first opportunity to bring the museum down to the conference in Miami. And I had no idea what's going to happen. But we had these tables, like I had the whole hallway. They gave me a hallway by the VIP, between VIP and something else over there. I had this whole corridor. And I put all these, I think at the time I had 72 machines or 75. And those 3 days were very memorable because I seen the reaction of the community. And the reaction that you get, and this is from every conference ever since, is when people walk around that corner and they see, like today, I have 123 machines. So we've almost doubled since then, 3 years ago. To see all this, it's Bitcoin, you can't touch it and you cannot see it. But when you come to the museum, it's the only tangible part of the whole Bitcoin network. It's something that you physically get to see. And we have newbies that walk around the corner and see all this. They're like, holy shit, this is real. That's crazy. There's already a museum? I thought this is new technology. No, this is not new. It's been around for 15 freaking years. You're just a little late. Well, I'm not going to say late because we're technically still early in the grand scheme of things.
Whether you're mining Bitcoin, buying Bitcoin, or earning Bitcoin, you need to keep those precious sats safe for the long haul. And the best way to do that is to go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code WALKER for 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then, of course, get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own custody. The Bitbox team is honestly awesome, and I just had Staticus from their team on my show the other week. If you wanted to get a deeper dive into their methodology and how they think about things, they build easy-to-use, secure, open-source solutions to keep your Bitcoin safe. And not only is the Bitcoin in your Bitbox safe from government confiscation, let's say, but Bitbox is also one of the only two wallets to specifically address the Dark Skippy vulnerability. So if you have one, you're in luck. And if you don't, you can pick one up. Plus, and I cannot emphasize this enough from personal experience, the Bitbox O2 is truly easy as hell to use. Whether you're new to Bitcoin and it's your very first hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath and you've got more than you'd like to admit, it is Bitcoin only. And again, fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify for yourself. There is no need to trust me or to trust Bitbox. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, and it's off anything in their store, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you. Always still early. No, I love it. And I mean, I've seen your setup before, and it's really cool. Like, it's cool because every time I end up talking to you, you tell me something that I had no idea about, you know, cause I've only been around since 2020, when I started stacking sats after, you know, ignoring Bitcoin a couple of times, thinking it was just some, you know, nerd money online or whatever stupid thing I told myself at the time. And then 2020 rolls around and, you know, you start stacking sats.
Say, 2013 was the first time I heard of it. And I remember my exact thoughts. This is internet money for geeks. Internet monopoly money for geeks. That's what my first thought was.
Yeah. And like, more power to the people who hear about Bitcoin for the first time and decide to dive right in. Like, I have a lot of respect for that, because it was not the first or the second or the third time that I heard about it that I dived in. But, you know, hey, we get into Bitcoin when we deserve to, right? When we're ready to do some research. But what I was going to say is, you know, seeing this history, I'd love if maybe you could walk through a little bit, just kind of the evolution of Bitcoin mining. Because I think a lot of people, they see what it is today, or, you know, like you said, if they haven't seen your collection, even the idea of Bitcoin mining, maybe something like what they know about it is what they've read in legacy media about, you know, oh, just a bunch of, you know, data centers competing to solve a puzzle, you know, or whatever simplified thing they do. But can you walk us through a little, like, okay, Bitcoin is created and mining obviously begins with the Genesis block. But mining looked a lot different then, and it changed a lot over the years. Can you kind of walk through that evolution of Bitcoin miners from where it started to where it is today?
Well, the first phase was laptops, CPU. That's when Satoshi started with his laptop. That phase was roughly about 2 years, give or take. And then you had the switched over to GPU. GPU era was also, give or take, 2 years. But a lot of that GPU stuff also switched over to the shitcoin world. But the network was so small in the early days that you could mine with CPU. Not a lot of people know this, but December 7th, 2010, there was a Nokia N900 cell phone that put the whole blockchain on the cell phone, and with the battery, it mined Bitcoin. I think it was 0.43 Bitcoin or something like that, and sent the transaction of that Bitcoin to another N900 cell phone, because the network was still small enough that you could use a cell phone to do that with. But after that, Bitcoin shot up, like, literally days later, to where you couldn't even do that anymore. But there is a moment in history on that day in 2010 where two people used two cell phones to mine Bitcoin and send Bitcoin.
Wow.
So, yeah, I wish wild. It was still that era. So from GPU, CPU and GPU, it's like, you know how you really only use 10% of your brain to think? GPU is like, you can do gaming, you can go online, you can check emails, you can do all kinds of stuff. But mining Bitcoin on GPU only uses a fraction. It doesn't use the whole GPU. Then we went actually to a short phase called FPGA. And FPGA lasted not even a year, maybe 6 months to a year. And this was basically, it was like an ASIC machine, an ASIC miner that you can program. So it's something between the GPU and the ASIC. So actually, let me show you.
I love that you've just, you know, you've got the examples ready to go. It's beautiful.
This is the oldest miner in my museum. And it took me 4 years to find, but this is an actual GPU. And, well, actually, let me just take it out instead of all that reflection. So as you can see, it says Bitcoin FPGA. That was the name of the company. I found the founder that made this. He's staying anonymous. I spoke to him for a while and had to build up my relationship and trust with him for him to open up about this. But I got a lot of information from him. There's not even maybe 900 of these that were ever made back then. A lot of them got thrown away or they're in the trash and recycled, and obviously they're not working no more. So there's no telling, excuse me, but maybe there's only a handful in the world left. He's got three and ended up negotiating with me in Bitcoin for me to buy one for the museum.
So these were at that time superior to what other people were running on GPUs.
Correct. So this is 250 megahertz. And this is basically one gigahash, all four of them. And you need over 2 million of these to equal today's S19, to put that in perspective.
That's wild.
That's how fast we have moved with efficiency. Then after this, on my right shoulder right there, under the shoe, is the Avalon. Can you see it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the Avalon 1, and that's the first ASIC miner that made it to market. And at the time that that got plugged in, Vitalik Buterin was the editor at Bitcoin Magazine, and he wrote the first article with... Jeff Garzik. Jeff Garzik received the first ASIC in the world. And when at the time that anybody plugged those in, they were making 20 to 25 Bitcoin a day on the blockchain. And it was 110 nanometer chips for the fourth phase, which is ASICs, which is what we're still on today. So basically, the invention of ASICs created the whole last decade of mining, of the mining community. But then the efficiency kept getting better and better and better, to where I think we're now at 3 nanometers in today's mining world. So from 110 to 3. And dealing with building, like the process of just making a new miner and getting the new chips is a huge deal. Just getting the chips themselves. I mean, you know what a wafer is from like TSMC? Yeah. Museum has one of those too. Not many people know what they look like.
Wow.
I think this is my first time showing one of these on the podcast.
That's awesome.
But there's 3,000 chips on this one wafer, and they're all 7 nanometers. So they're S17, early S19 era.
So we're, you know, we're in this ASIC era right now, and obviously that, you know, various iterations of ASIC. Wait, you got something else there?
Yeah. So besides the Avalon 1, which made it to market first, so they get credibility for bringing it out first to market, there's an unofficial first, and that is these. This is an ASIC miner made by Friedcat. Friedcat is a very controversial name from that era. It's I kind of consider Friedcat is like this skinny Chinese kid who is a genius who built from his own mind the design of the chips, which is a 130 nanometer chip on here. But he went to Harvard, and then he figured Bitcoin out and figured the chip situation out, and literally quit the whole Harvard stuff and then just started building his company, got into mining. But the reason why he didn't make it to market first is because he was selling the hash to the public and mining himself at the time that the Avalon 1 was being made. So it was like the Avalon 1 and this was in the same time frame, but Avalon made it out to market to sell to the public first, and then he came out just a few months later, but technically he was mining first. You know what I mean? So Avalon 1 is official, this is unofficial. And then Butterfly Labs, they were the first to open their mouth officially, but never made nothing happen. Like three different things all at the same time.
So where, you know, what was, I guess, the first modern, or what we'd call like modern ASIC? Because these Avalons, like these are ones people aren't going to have heard of. Like, is the S9 what you would consider
S9
like the first?
S9 is the most legendary machine to me.
Yeah.
It's the cat with nine lives. You know, Bitcoin tanked and they're... Miners are cheap at the time, and then people throw them away, and then Bitcoin takes off, and then they're like, where the heck did I put that miner? And they put it back online. I remember that people ran those for quite a long time, and they were beasts. Like the miners that I deployed for Core Scientific at one of the sites, there was literally every day 18-wheeler truckloads of S9s coming in from China. And a couple of the loads were used miners, and we had to refurbish them before we put them online. So I had this whole triage set up with my team with these 8-foot tables where every person had their own job. And then the box shows up with the miners. They look like straight crap. And then they go through the process of being taken apart, cleaned, reprogrammed on the SD card, on the control board with the SD card, and then tested, and then go put them online. But those miners went through a mudslide in China. So they had mud caked all in them. We literally washed them and then put them in the hot aisle and let them dry out, then went and put them through triage, and they worked. They ran with no problem. It's like mind-blowing. There were dead spiders in there that we found from China. There was cigarette butts from people that were working on the site in China that we found inside the miner. Like all kinds of crazy crap from overseas that came through these machines. So this is like a weird experience. But yeah, the S9 is to me the most legendary machine. And I actually have one that's unopened in the original box. Never been opened. I'm not opening it.
Wow, that's quite a collector's item right there, right? You know, if you keep it in the box,
then you
know,
never have no, it's not in here. I have the S1, the first Bitmain antminer ever made, brand new, never used. It's still an original box. I just got that like a week ago. I just tweeted about it, or 2 weeks ago.
That's so. That's like, and obviously the S9 had a pretty. Has a probably what the longest run of any specific miner, is that fair to say?
Yes.
And now I mean,
one guy told me that he made a return on his investment fivefold with the S9 because he first bought them when they first came out and they just ran for so long that he fivefolded his money with that same machine.
Wow, that's nuts. And how for people perspective, how does that S9 compare to the latest and greatest machines that are coming out now?
I think as the chips become more efficient, they become more fragile. Meaning like you put them in certain environments like hot West Texas weather. There's the S19XP, don't like heat. I'm already hearing the S21s, don't like heat. The S9 is one of those machines that you could have ran in Canada and in 10 degree weather or even some negative degree weather and in the hot weather in Texas, but no problem. So as the chips, the nanometer, the chips become more efficient, I think it's going to get more and more difficult to where air cooling is probably going to go away and you're going to have to deal with hydro cooling and immersion cooling and things of that nature, unless they come up with a whole new chip design that has something other than copper on the inside that can make it more efficient that way.
That's actually what I wanted to ask you too is, okay, we're in this ASIC era, right? And I mean, is there an era after the ASIC era, or is it just different iterations making these ASICs more and more efficient, you know, increasing the hash of these? Is this kind of like the final stop? Is there something that comes after this, or is this just kind of what we have and we just keep getting more efficient?
I think we're getting close to a plateau on the nanometer side. Maybe we get to 2, maybe we get to 1.5. I don't know how much further we go after that. I think efficiency is some of the focus right now. There was one company that they got bought out by Bitdeer, but it's called Desawi Miner. I had one of their machines, and the technology inside, they actually went backwards on the nanometer chip. Even though at the time we were at the 5-nanometer level, they went backwards to 8, but they had better numbers than a miner with 5 nanometers. And I'm like, how is that possible? So we opened it up and did a whole, dissected it basically. And through that process, we learned that they changed the entire heat sink process with copper piping. It's a little more expensive, but the technology changed and they went to putting over 1,000 chips into one machine. Usually, on average, a machine has 300 or 400 chips together, all in the whole miner. These guys, they put over 1,000 machines, chips of the 8 nanometer in there. So they went for something that's more durable and easier to get on the chip side, but then put more of them in the machine and then solved a better solution on the heat side for the heat sink system. And I kind of liked that because I had no issues with that machine whatsoever. I kept that in my crawl space to keep my floor and my house warm through the winter. And that thing was a beast.
You know, it's fascinating.
But to be able to tell the future, to answer your question about if there's anything after ASICs, I can't really say. I don't know. I just, right now, I know that we're on solving things around whatever chipsets that we have right now to make things better until something better comes along. Maybe, you know, people are always inventing things.
And thank goodness for human creativity. You know, it's fascinating, too, because I think... Well, yeah, you know, we can try anyway. We can try, but well, that's something I wanted to talk to you about too. Because if we talk about the pipeline for Bitcoin miners, right? It is primarily right now that supply chain is pretty dependent on China. Fair to say? I mean, do you see centralization risk in that? Like, obviously, miners themselves, you can mine anywhere in the world, you know, even in China, where it's been, you know, banned however many times. But the production process, that actual supply chain, it's reliant on pretty heavily centralized group of manufacturers, right? Do you see that as a risk? Do you see avenues for that decentralizing a bit to spread that out? Or how do you look at that?
All depends on who wins November 5th. Because from there, you can make decisions to say, okay, well, we want more productivity in the U.S., so we're going to give tax breaks to companies that come back and to do things here. I mean, at the end of the day, everybody's always chasing the cheaper labor, the cheaper parts, the cheaper this and that. It sucks that it's centralized in China for the most part. But you have companies like Auradine. They're out of California. They're doing things in the U.S. I heard that WhatsMiner is actually at least piecing miners together with parts in the U.S. Then you have, on the smaller scale, which is a good start, you have like Bitax. You know, you have these home miners, these little small miners. Yeah, you're not going to get rich off of them. You're not going to get payouts every week or whatever. But if you have a million of them out there, you just helped decentralize the network more to where it's not all controlled in one place. And these are people that are in the U.S. making stuff from home with their own D3 printer and things like that, as long as they have the base card with the chip in it. And I think that's pretty cool that that's actually starting. And so you almost thought home mining was dead, but now people are becoming innovative with the newer chips and making home miners again. And that helps to decentralize the network.
It is pretty cool. I've been meaning to order myself a Bitax because I think that's just that's a cool project. And like that, it's again, that's one of the beautiful things about Bitcoin, right? Like, sure. Does a massive mining farm have, are they going to be able to spin up more hash rate than you in your basement? Yeah. But that doesn't, just because they have all that hash rate does not mean you cannot also have hash rate yourself. You know, nothing is stopping you as the individual from going out there and getting a miner and being able to mine yourself. Like, and that's kind of that's a beautiful thing, right? It's like, yeah, it doesn't mean it's going to be a fair fight on terms of scale, but the process of Bitcoin mining, like the actual hashing, is about as fair a fight as something can possibly be if we talk about actually trying to go through the process of discovering that next block. So at least we got that going for us, right?
Yeah. I recommend that anybody mine from home, even if it's just to reheat something, your crawl space, your shed, your greenhouse or whatever, you're not going to, like I said, you're not going to get rich off of it. But just to be able to say, I'm a part of the network and I'm helping to contribute to the network is pretty cool in my view. And a lot of the people that first get into mining at home, are always like, well, what do the numbers look like? You know, if I buy this for $500, then what am I going to make for it every month? It's like, there's number one, there's too many variables involved to answer that. And these calculators they have online will give you a basic real-time idea, but that will change next week. The numbers change, the difficulty changes, the price of Bitcoin changes. So what I do is I don't think about any of that. What I do, and I put my mind frame this on this early on. If just for numbers' sake, if my miner costs $100 a month in electricity to mine, but I make $80 in Bitcoin, the average person is like, damn, I just lost $20. But that's the fiat mind frame. I look at it and be like, hey, I got $80 worth of freaking Bitcoin, virgin Bitcoin, that is 10x from now, that's $800. So it's like, who cares about the $20 that I just lost last month in electricity if it's going to be an $800 asset by the end of the decade or something? So I'm looking at the long-term play with this at the same time that I'm using it to recycle the heat in many different ways.
I think that's such a great mindset to have because you're right. I mean, it is a very, and this is the thing, as a home miner, you can have that mindset that obviously like a publicly traded Bitcoin miner cannot have. They do need to worry about how, like, what does it cost them on a month-to-month basis? Are they profitable? But as a home miner, you can say, okay, you know, I'm just doing a little bit of mining on the side. I'm getting a little bit of, as you said, virgin Bitcoin for it, which it's one, I mean, at least personally, I would say there's a premium on that. If that's non, that didn't come from an exchange, you didn't have to,
Transaction.
yeah, you didn't have to give, you know, your firstborn son and your social security number away to the exchange to get that Bitcoin. That's just came right to you. And I mean, that alone has a premium on it in my mind. But then also, like you said, if you've got a long-term mindset, well, that Bitcoin's going to be worth a heck of a lot more if you're just, you know, if you're holding on to it and just doing this as something to help promote the decentralization of the network and get some of that virgin Bitcoin on the side. Like that's a beautiful thing. I'm curious if you have a recommendation for folks who want to start home mining, but are unfamiliar with mining more generally. You know, they haven't done this before. What would you say? I mean, you recommend they start with like with one of these Bitaxes, or you know, I mean, depends on their budget, I suppose. But do you have a like when people ask you about this, what do you tell them?
Usually the people that I deal with, I have not been big on the home mining when it comes to the USB stuff with, you know, the small things. I'm usually S9 and above. So I actually tell people go on eBay, order a working S9, because that's basically the highest miner that does the most on 110 electricity before you graduate to 220. So you can still plug that into a 110 and consider that, not that you're making Bitcoin and you're going to do something big in the future with it, but that this is your GED for mining. You're buying this S9 from eBay, and you're going through the process of learning the UI, learning how to troubleshoot it, test it, open it up, look at the inside, how do you connect your wallet to it. Go through that whole process of basically that's like your little high school diploma that you're buying this S9 for. And then from there, you can make a decision. Do I like it? I didn't like the noise. I don't want to mine because of the noise. Whatever the case may be, you're going to come up with your own reasons of why you want to continue or don't want to continue from there on. So I would recommend going to eBay and just find one of those 110 outlet type miners and go from there. And then if you like it, then move up and advance to 220. And yeah, there's a lot of tutorials and YouTube videos and a lot of, you know, bits be tripping and hustle miner, and I got brain fart. There's quite a few miners out there that teach this type of stuff that have plenty of videos. That's how I did it too.
And that's great. What about for somebody who wants to maybe get into the Bitcoin mining industry? You know, because you've had a pretty cool journey doing it basically from the bottom up, self-taught basically around all of this. Not that there's like a university for Bitcoin mining, at least yet. Maybe we start to see that in a number of years. Who knows? But you know, what's for folks that are maybe in a similar position to you were, where they're still working a fiat job and they're thinking, okay, I want to dip my toes into Bitcoin mining. Like this is what I think is really fascinating. You have any advice for folks who want to make that jump, or just, you know, what was your kind of final catalyst where you said, nope, I need to do this?
I kind of stepped out to a broader view on a personal level because I experienced the dips and the takeoffs of I experienced the roller coaster. And when I had my LLC, when I started, and I was doing the whole technician stuff, I also learned brokering. So like I've closed some deals here and there with publicly traded companies where I get my little cut. Or I would close a hosting deal with a company and they would call me and say, hey, we got 5 megawatts of racking space. Can you find me some miners? And then I call the people that I connect with or have a network with and find somebody. And through that whole process, I'm like, I realized that selling miners is hot when Bitcoin takes off. But when Bitcoin tanks, nobody wants any. And then my company's kind of like dead in the water. So I had to figure out other things. So I was like that broad view of, I want to learn this, 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 and this. So I don't care what price Bitcoin is on the roller coaster. I'm busy. I'm doing something. And that's what I ended up doing. And that's how I approach things. So I guess you kind of have to figure out for yourself, like, how much time do you have to invest into this? Are you willing to travel to leave your family? Are you a single guy and you don't mind being at a mining site in Kansas and then 2 weeks later in North Dakota freezing your ass off at 23 degrees and then down to Georgia sweating your butt off? So like, it's what are you wanting to do? What's your capacity to be able to do things in the space? But there's a lot of demand. You just have to find it and network, and that's what these conferences are perfect for too, and that's why I love going to those. Because you get this, like me and you, you know, I've known you off the internet, never met you until we went to a conference. So after you meet people, you can say, yeah, like I met him, I know him, I know that he's not some scammer on Telegram, he's legit. Hey, come over and help me out, I'll pay you $25 an hour to deploy 5,000 machines. You know, so it's like, you just have to get involved in the community and network and figure out for yourself what you want to do with your time and which way you want to go.
Yeah.
Me, it was just a broad view of things.
I love it. I'm curious. I wanted to ask you also just about mining pools, because this is, you know, just on the topic of centralization in general. Do you view this as at all of a risk in terms of a lot of hash power being pulled into just a, you know, handful of pretty big pools? Or is that something that is not so worrisome because, okay, people still have the option to not, you know, mine with one of these pools or to start a new pool? What are your thoughts on that? Because I see, you know, a lot of people that are saying, hey, we really need to pay attention to this. This is a, you know, a potentially big threat. And other people saying, eh, you know, it'll work itself out.
I know that Ocean Pool is not a pool that's very much liked by some people in the community, but I think that it's a need in the community because the options that they provide to help exactly the topic that you're talking about, because you have the Foundries of the world and the Ant Pools of the world that have a lot of hash power. The whole thing with like using block space to put other things outside of transactions, I'm still kind of on the fence with all that stuff. I understand both sides of point of views, but with the hash rate being centralized, I don't know if this is true, but somebody told me that some of the Asian ones that even though they're different name pools, they still are somehow connected to each other. I don't know, some podcast that I was listening, not a podcast, it was a Spaces. Somebody was saying something like that. I mean, yeah, that's kind of nerve-wracking. I'm hoping that, you know, if the right person becomes president and we have the right cabinet in the office where they have the right mind frame, that some of that stuff starts coming on, not just the mining parts and the mining themselves with the machines, but also the pool side has be based out of the U.S. too, to start taking things away from the Asian side. But
and by that, you mean
I'm not
just
really
the control?
A very well experienced person when it comes to the pools themselves. I'm more in the mining and the museum side. Sure. I just know, hey, I plug into this pool and I get my payout.
Yeah,
I joined Ocean from the very beginning. So I was part of the first few blocks that they ever made, and it was pretty dope to get larger payouts than what I'm used to because the network was small, and to find blocks that quickly at the beginning was a cool experience.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, again, it's cool that there are these other pools spinning up that are starting to get more hash rate. And, you know, I'm curious, just because you mentioned, you know, the election, obviously Trump has been much more vocally pro Bitcoin and crypto, granted. But talking about Bitcoin as an industry at the Bitcoin conference, and I think, again, it's not so much, at least in my opinion, it's not so much what he said, it's the fact that he was there at the conference saying it, because that means that it forces people to pay attention a little bit more. And even if the only result of that is that a few more people who really need Bitcoin end up finding it because they didn't think about Bitcoin before, but because Donald Trump talked about it, they started paying attention, well, then I think that's a positive thing. But zooming out a little bit, you know, how do you see the future? And obviously, Trump said stuff like, we want every Bitcoin mined in the future to be mined in America. Of course, it's impossible. But, you know, I think it's a good sentiment, even if it's a little nonsensical. But how do you see this working out? Because, I mean, really what we're talking about, you know, at the core is you need cheap energy, right? And so, you know, how do you see this shaking out? You know, let's say, does it come down to we're going to drill, baby, drill, and there's just going to be, you know, we're going to drop energy prices, and so it's going to become a lot more economical to mine all over the U.S. versus just in some of these areas like in Texas, where obviously they have ERCOT and they're doing a lot of load balancing down there. How do you see that shaking out, you know, to be in these next few years, assuming Trump does win?
So I was there for Trump's speech, and like somebody made the comment saying that from the way that he spoke in a speech, you can tell that he really doesn't understand Bitcoin well yet. I mean, it's fairly new to him, so I don't expect him to know a lot, especially that comment at the end about play with your Bitcoin. It's like, whatever, you know. But like you said, and to me, what I consider for that moment to be is like, and not just the moment, but last night, or today, he spoke about Bitcoin again at whatever event at lunchtime. So he mentioned Bitcoin again. To me, he's the world's largest billboard for Bitcoin. And it's just like, that's freaking awesome. That helps mass adoption. Rather, he personally likes it or doesn't personally like it. The other thing that I pay attention to is who does he surround himself with that is into Bitcoin? And you have RFK that's supposed to be joining. You have got Elon Musk that's talking about joining. You got VP Vance, who admitted that he owns $1 million worth of Bitcoin, roughly $1 million between ETFs and personal Bitcoin. So just that alone is awesome. Vivek, he's big into Bitcoin. I'm hoping that he wins, I ain't gonna lie, but if he wins and he has that type of cabinet and they do drill, baby, drill, then yeah, you're going to have energy in Texas and the Dakotas and other places where the prices are going to drop. And then I see an incentive being pushed out to where they say, okay, let's just say, you know, we're on this grid and this substation over here has 60 megawatts in the middle of nowhere and it's not being used. If you miners come with your own CapEx and bring containers over here and connect to this grid, then we're going to give you a certain mining rate that's cheaper than anything else because we would rather have 3.5 cents than nothing. You know, so there's a lot of substations out there on the grids that energy is not being used, it's just sitting there wasting. So I see things like that happening. But you still have certain parts of the world, and sad to say, we're kind of in my own backyard with this problem, but Duke Energy is our grid provider, and you still have some of the old school fiat heads in charge who have monopoly, and whatever they say goes. And some of them are in a learning curve right now, and some of them are still stubborn. But like if you go down to Georgia Power, for example, you could sit down at the negotiating table and have three, four energy companies that they're fighting for your service. So you can actually negotiate a rate if you're starting from the ground up. But in Duke, it's like, this is what you get, take it or go somewhere else. So that has to change because you have these utility commission folks, you know, that make the decision about what the energy company does, and they have these relationships, and it's all political behind the scenes. Prime example, Duke Energy made $6 billion in profits last year, but then they raised their rates a few months ago. It's like, why are you raising rates if you made so much money in profits last year? And then they say, well, because of AI coming in, we need more energy, but we need more money to build new sites for new energy. So it's like, why don't you just bring miners in and then balance it that way? You know, you can balance the grid with mining.
It's so funny whenever I hear things, you know, sometimes you'll see a headline that's like, you know, oh, this much, you know, there's this much flared methane every year, and we have to do something about this, or some other such headline, or like this case, you know, we need to build out more energy infrastructure, but we have to pay for it. And it's like, huh, if only there was a way, if only there, and it's like, well, you know, Bitcoin. Yeah. Bitcoin mining. It's there. It exists.
In North Carolina, we have tobacco plants that are shut down 10, 20 years ago. You have upholstery shops where they made jeans or whatever. And these plants, they have substations on site, but the grass is 6 feet tall. And the towns are so small, they don't have enough money on in their account for them to go and keep it up and make it look pretty. You can literally just have miners come in and clean the whole thing up and start mining and give jobs, and then you can have some money go back to the city to fix potholes and things of that nature. So it's like these rural towns in North Carolina can be revitalized through Bitcoin mining, and this is something that I'm actually a part of with something called the North Carolina Blockchain Initiative, as NCBI. So it's me and half a dozen other people that are all experts in their own right, rather it's be a crypto lawyer or Dan Spooler from Washington, D.C. He's heading it all. But we're under Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. And what we're doing, we've been educating politicians, and we've been working with Duke Energy and some of the people that are working at Duke Energy to try to orange pill, basically. So through this process, we're kind of hoping that we can make a turn here in the future and get things on the right track.
Do you think that kind of is that's the optimistic future for mining in America? Is a lot of this, these cases like this, these towns that are all over rural America. I mean, you know, every state has these type of towns that used to make something, and now they don't anymore. And those towns have gotten run down, but they may still have some of that infrastructure in place.
They do.
Do you see this kind of, you know, almost a rural renaissance happening enabled by Bitcoin mining, if we, you know, as long as we don't make life hell for Bitcoin miners?
It all depends back to politics and which side of politics you're on. Like I said, I was a truck driver. I used to do oil tankers, but then after that, I did deliveries with box trucks and other 18-wheeler stuff. So I got a lot of miles under my belt from my early days where I would go through small towns. And I could tell just from driving through. That's all I did. From the beginning of the entrance that says, welcome to whatever the name of the town, to have a good day at the end. I would go around the courthouse and you could see for rent, for rent, for rent. And just three cars parked over here, two cars parked over there. And I'm like, this is a Democratic run side of the city. And sure enough, you look at the leadership and it's on that side of the house. And then you get to the Republican side of towns, and it's like these small towns are booming with flower shops, with whatever, like the local farmers market is super active, and there's cars, there's traffic throughout the day in these small towns. They're booming. Those are the local community leaders that are making the right decisions about where to spend money and where do they make money from. And it's technically, those are the towns that are more friendly towards an open dialogue to the mining community and learning and saying, hey, you know what? It doesn't hurt to give it a try and see what happens. Let's do a 1 or 2 year contract with these people. And then from there, they see money flowing in and they're like, hey, this is dope. And we got 5 new jobs they opened up. In one town in Georgia, it was crickets. They had one police officer And that one cop couldn't, and it's like, I don't know, I think 1,500 people were living in this town. But because of the miner that they accepted to come in to take over this facility, they made enough revenue in 1 year to where they bought a new police car and hired a second police officer and upgraded their fire truck. So it's like, miners did that, you know, that's dope. Like, we're helping to revitalize these small communities that are open-minded, though. And for right now, it's, sorry to say, it's between these two political parties, rather not, they're open-minded about it.
You know, it's a shame, because I truly believe that Bitcoin is apolitical, right? Like, if you are, you identify as someone who's a conservative person, there's a lot to love about Bitcoin, right? This is a return to sound money. This is something that is incentivizing a hopefully smaller government and more localism. But even if you identify as a progressive, there's a lot to love about Bitcoin. This is a fucking revolution here. This is literally progress. This is what progress looks like. This is what progressing looks like. And so I think it's a shame that folks on the left have not embraced Bitcoin more. Because, and it comes from a lot of media brainwashing that's out there and them paying too much attention to that. But, you know, I think we all know from personal experience that what does it take to understand Bitcoin or to start to understand it? Well, it takes an openness. It takes a willingness to admit that maybe how you think things work is not how they really work, and that there's a lot of shit going on behind the scenes that you just wanted to cover your eyes and not pay attention to. But if you're willing to admit that, you know what, maybe I didn't understand how money works very well. Maybe I didn't understand how this political racket game of kleptocracy works very well. If you're willing to admit that, to set aside your priors, well, then you're ready to start learning about Bitcoin. And I think that maybe folks on the right have been more willing to do that because they're starting from a position of less trust in the government to begin with. You know what I mean? But I hope, I mean, I sincerely hope that Bitcoin ends up being something that is accepted and loved by folks, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. And I think that it is at a small level, but when we talk about the national conversation, or even to your point, a local conversation, there's still, I mean, you're talking about this from experience. You've seen a difference in terms of their receptiveness to Bitcoin miners coming in. And ultimately it should be a pretty easy yes. It's like Bitcoin miners want to come in here and they want to bring us more revenue and bring us more jobs. Why the heck do you turn that down? So I hope that we see a little more openness to this on the left side of the aisle. And ultimately, I think maybe Bitcoin's something that brings folks a little bit closer together, closer to the center at the end of the day, because it's something that we should all be able to agree on. At least, you know, I hope, because Bitcoin doesn't care, right? That's the beauty of it. Doesn't care if you're red or blue. Bitcoin just is. And that's a beautiful thing. And I hope that that's something that brings folks closer together.
I'm looking forward to a future where the country could almost be like the conferences that we attend. I don't care if you're gay, black, fat, skinny, short, white, it doesn't matter. Everybody's there for the same reasons. And to me, Bitcoin conferences are like a neutral zone. And I think as a nation, it would be nice to be that way, you know, where everybody understands, all right, we need to do things the proper way. We need better money. At the end of the day, all the problems we have in this country, they all lead back to one freaking thing, and that's the money. And if we can fix that, then from there, trickle down, everything else will fix itself over time. So
yeah, no, I agree. I mean, yeah, fix the money, fix the world, right? It's not just a cliche. Like, we really have to, anything else that we do, any other political solution that doesn't start with fixing the money, well, that's not a cure. That's a, you know, it's a Band-Aid on a chainsaw wound. Like, it might maybe makes you feel a little bit better, but it's not doing much. You know, you got to get down to that base layer. And I think that is also why I have so much hope in the future, though, because I see things like, that's the great thing about going to conferences and being with Bitcoiners in person, is that you see people, they may not agree on one damn thing, but except for Bitcoin is good. And that's enough. No, we need more things like that bring us together instead of tearing us apart and creating these artificial divides. That just, what do those divides do? Well, that's just a tool for us all to be controlled, because like we said earlier, you're too busy fighting your neighbor or fighting with your family to realize that you're being robbed blind by the government, you know?
Yeah. Man. The whole tax side of things, that's a whole
other... Yeah, we could have a whole nother show about that. But what, hey, I want to be conscious of your time here because this has been a great rip. And I just want to check, is there anything that you wanted to cover today that we didn't get a chance to talk about at all?
Yeah. There is something that I think is pretty dope in the Bitcoin community. I don't know if, yeah, you do know about them because you're actually involved in it.
Those Bitcoin trading cards?
Bitcoin trading cards. They're dope. Awesome. Like, I got all into it. Like, this right here is a $1,200 pack because it's from the first series. Like, the reason why I got into it is because when I went to the conference, you know how you had all the booths over there and you got 2 people here, 5 people here, 10 people here. But then I look at this 40 people standing around this small little booth and I'm like, what the heck is going on over there? And then everybody's buying these and trading cards and they're all involved in it. And I bought a deck and ripped it open and I ended up getting a box. And then the owner, Aladdin, he was like, yeah, I asked about a Michael Saylor card. Because, you know, I had my whale band and I wanted to see if I can get close to Michael Saylor to get him to sign it. And he was like, yeah, nobody's been able to do that yet since we started this. So that was like a challenge to me. A challenge accepted. So I ended up taking my sneaker right here. Basically, these sneakers are, I bring them to all the conferences and I get a lot of the Bitcoin the big shots in the Bitcoin space to sign them. So you got like Jack Dorsey, Michael Saylor, Adam Back, Tone Vase, Alex Gladstein, Max Kaiser. But I didn't have Michael Saylor on the shoe. So I took the shoe and I finally intercepted him between him and his security. And I was like, sir, I've been trying to get you to sign the shoe for a few conferences now. Can you please sign it this time? So he's like, okay. So he signs it and I get it on video, but then I had this Michael Saylor card right here and it was in my top pocket and he was about to walk off and I'm like, sir, can you please sign one more thing, please? And we're in an open space though. You know that the place for the conference was pretty open. And he was like, well, there's no table. Where do I even put it? So I flipped the shoe upside down. Put the card right there. And he looked at me like, that's some slick shit. And so I actually got 2 of these signed. I had 2 of them on me. I got 2 of them signed, and they're the first ones in the world signed by Michael Saylor. One of them the owner of the company has, and the other one I have for my museum. But man, I got into it ever since, and now I have like binders and stuff with some of the coolest cards ever made by them. Because if you think like getting into Pokemon early, like I looked it up online, Pokemon has printed 64 billion cards since they came out with a B. There's 8 billion people on the planet. And out of those 64 billion, you still have super rare, expensive cards that are rare. Collector stuff, you know, on the highest scale. Here we are with cards and including you guys that are on yours because you're in it. He has not even, I think he's close to only 1 million printed. Compare 1 million after 2 years of doing this to 64 billion. Like, we're very early on this. And, like, look how beautiful these cards are with the hologram glitter stuff and the designs that they come up with. It's pretty dope. And I see this, like, kind of like Bitcoin. You got the serial number in the back that says 1 out of 21. This card right here, I think right now is $600-$700, but it'll $4,000-$6,000 in a few years. Who knows?
And it's just fun, right? Like it's just
fun. Aladdin. Educational.
Yeah, and that's the big thing. Like you know, they've done such a good job over there. Aladdin's an awesome dude, and yeah. Like, the fact that they build education into everything that they're doing, like they're you know, we're not talking about you know baseball stats in the back of these things, you know, or made up. You know, Pokemon characteristics. We're talking about really great distilled Bitcoin knowledge on the back of these. So if you got, you know, kids or adults are trading them around, it's like you're learning something. I think that's beautiful.
A box of these, and I have them in my truck. I have them in my pocket, And every time I run into somebody and I have a conversation about Bitcoin, right before the end conversation is done, I pull this out, I hand this to them, and I was like, there's all kinds of information with hope.com and other websites in the back of these cards. Please get educated. And then I also now tell them, watch God Bless Bitcoin. I think that's a pretty dope documentary that helps understand newbies. So like my neighbor, he just moved in, bought a house down the street. I caught him walking his dog and I told him about Bitcoin. Orange peeled him and I said, hey, go watch God Bless Bitcoin. And he just finished watching it yesterday. And he was the one of the ones that said, nah, the US dollar is the strongest thing in the world. And, you know, pull out a $20 bill. I can touch it. I can see it. I'm not going to stop using that. You know, it's like now he opened up his mind to at least watch the documentary, and that opened up his mind to continue down the rabbit hole now. And now he has a different point of view on it in just one day.
That's an effective orange pill right there. And yeah, you pair that with a cool package.
It's something physical that you can hand them, and then they see it sitting on their desk later or whatever, and like, let me look at it. Because if you just tell somebody something, most likely they'll forget about it. The people that don't have nothing to see when you tell them about it are the types of people that usually have to hear Bitcoin three times from three different people in three different places before they start taking it seriously. It's kind of a psychological thing. I don't know why.
Yeah. But
that's one reason why I also open my mouth in public. Like, I'm at Publix, I'm grocery shopping, and I literally just do something like as small as making a joke to the lady in front of me, asking the cashier, do you guys accept Bitcoin? And that's all I say. But my comment, I might be the third person to that woman. And then she goes home, she's like, dang, that's the third time I heard somebody say Bitcoin. Let me go look this up. I had no conversation with her except that. Hey, you accept Bitcoin? That's it. But I might be the second person or the third person or the first. I don't know. But it's a part of the mass adoption process.
Now, it is so important. It's those continued touch points, because you never know when something's going to be the spark that makes somebody say, you know what? I need to look into this thing. And it's beautiful. And, you know, I want to say thank you for your time here today. This was fascinating. I appreciate the history of the mining industry too, because that's just cool. Where do you want to send people? I'll make sure to link in the show notes to your social media, but should they head to the museum website? Where do you want to send people to?
On X, it's BTC Mining Museum. And then the website, which we built from the ground up, shouts out to Tyler and Parker and Lance. I have a 5-man crew with the museum that helps out. They helped build the website. It's called BitcoinMiningMuseum.com. Right now, I do want to point out that these conferences, I'm learning now that as the museum grows in size and value, because there's value in all this 4 years of legwork of building and putting it all together and having the history to show, when I drive from here to 1,000 miles to Miami, or I've driven all the way to Austin, Texas with it before, 3-day trip, you're pulling a trailer, you know, I had the experience of a flat tire and a miner fell off the shelf, even though I got custom shelves with foam in them and stuff to protect them. When the leaf spring hit the ground and it smacked so hard that a miner fell off and it broke. Luckily, it was not a very rare miner. I was able to replace it. But then I get to the conference and somebody drinking alcohol bumps into it on the table and another one broke. And then I'm thinking to myself, what is if I get T-boned on my way home, 1,000 miles back home, and all of my history is gone in one freaking accident? Then what? So it's like I'm at that brick and mortar moment now where I have to preserve. And it doesn't have to be me. I can pass the baton to somebody that has the CapEx, that has a facility in Miami or in some popular place like Nashville or whatever that has a lot of Bitcoiners, that can take the baton, and then I'm a part of the process with the transition with my team where we can still continue to help out or whatever, but for it to grow in a centralized location, and then maybe even build a small mobile one to take the conferences that's extra, like these behind me, these are extra. These can go to the museum, to the conference, while there's the main ones stay put and are protected. Because like imagine Apple, Steve Jobs, He made his first 200 machines with the Apple I computer in his garage at home. That's what that Avalon One is for Bitcoin. That's an Apple One for Bitcoin, basically. If that breaks and there's only a handful left in the world and I don't know how to replace it because I don't know anybody else has them but me, what do you do? you know? So it's like we have to preserve this history. Like the people that are, the kids that are coming out today and they have their Apple 15 or whatever number we're at, an S24, that's how they're starting off their technology, is with this new technology. How do they know or learn about the history if it doesn't exist, of where Bitcoin started? So I would love to put the word out there that if any Michael Saylors of the world, or I don't know, Jack Dorsey, that might have some of the CapEx to help preserve some of this stuff and come up with something cool. It doesn't have to be a boring museum either. It could be the world's first Bitcoin event center where Bitcoin maxis can rent the place out for their wedding, you know, and be surrounded with a history of Bitcoin and have these Mission Impossible laser lights shooting over this thing back here, and have the Genesis block all over the floor with S9 LED lights hanging off the ceiling, you know?
it sounds pretty badass to me. I'd renew my vows there with my wife, you know, just that sounds like a blast.
Field trips for schools. Schools that start getting into Bitcoin, they can do a field trip to this event center during the day and get educated over there. And then even have a bar with some grill on the side or some steakhouse that serves drinks that are called creme de la shrimp, like Charlie Shrimp. Keep the legacy alive for some of these guys. You know, some Bailey's Irish cream, creme de la shrimp. I don't know.
You got the start of a menu already. Yeah. I love it. I hope somebody takes you up on that. And if you're listening, and sounds like you might want to be that person, publicly or anonymously, reach out to the Coin Dad, because it's a beautiful thing that you're keeping this history alive and educating people on it. And so I thank you for that, because it's something that needs to be preserved, and I'm glad that you're doing it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. It's not a lot of people out there, honestly, that appreciate this yet, because I feel like even though Bitcoin's early, I'm even earlier with the idea of a museum. But the conference events of the type of people, I've had a 10, 12 year old kid come up with his mom and ask questions of how he can start mining at his mother's cabin in the mountains in Virginia because it's cold and they want to have some heat in there while he's making Bitcoin. And the kids just became a teenager. So it's like, and then having I had a probably 75, 80 year old grandmother that came through and asked questions about mining. So it's like this wide range of people at these conferences that see the museum and start asking questions and wanting to get involved. So I think that's important to preserve the history. And that's what I've been working on.
I'm at the
point where I can't do it anymore on my own. It's time for the next phase. And if anybody's out there listening, reach out to me, and we would love to make something else happen.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for your time. Bitcoin is scarce, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for coming on this one, sharing your scarce time with me. This was
appreciate
a pleasure.
You. Thank you very much for having me on.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin Podcast, consider giving the show a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing the show with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I always appreciate it. You can find me on Noster by going to primal.net/walker. If you want to follow the Bitcoin Podcast on Twitter, go to @TitcoinPodcast and @WalkerAmerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@WalkerAmerica and @WalkerAmerica on Rumble. Or just go to bitcoinpodcast.net/podcast and find links everywhere. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.